The Sunstone Foundation presents Comparing and Contrasting Early Christian and Mormon Concepts of Deification, recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We take you now to the University of Utah campus, where the program is about to begin.
And ask the two people who are involved in this to tell something of themselves, just whatever you think might be germane. We'll ask the paper to be presented first, and then we'll have the respondent, and then we'll just do it more casually, but at least we ought to begin.
Well, this is good, because I had intended for this to be very casual anyway, there had arisen a little difficulty regarding the respondent to my paper. I had decided to make somewhat of a casual presentation this time, and Bill Connect has been asked kind of at the last minute to make some response, and so it looks like the whole session is going to be very casual. I am Van Hale, and I don't ever like to say anything about myself. Maybe I should have my wife or my mother come say something. But then there may not be time for my paper. But I have had a lot of interest in over the last, Mormon history and doctrine has been a hobby of mine since the time I went on a mission to Northern California in 1964. And I have pursued that and have participated in most of the Sunstone symposiums over the last, I guess it's about 10 years now. And have just participated in as kind of a history buff and someone who has an interest in these kinds of topics. I also, with a friend, hosted a talk radio show for 8 years on the topic of Mormonism here in the area, and that was a lot of fun, and lasted until a fundamentalist Christian group bought the radio station and decided that our brand of talk radio was not welcome on the station, so that ended that. My subject, or my title today, let me just spread some of these papers out. My title today is Comparing and Contrasting Early Christian and Mormon Concepts of Deification. Now, what I will be talking about is the LDS view of salvation and God, particularly the belief that men have the potential of becoming gods. And I will also be talking about the early Christian views of salvation and God, primarily during the first 5 centuries, particularly the belief that men have the potential of becoming gods. And I have some good news and some bad news. There are substantial comparisons between Mormon and early Christian views, and there are also substantial contrasts between early Christian and Mormon views. That's the good news and the bad news, but the question is which is which? And which is the good news and which is the bad news in that respect depends upon your particular point of view. And let me just expand upon that a little bit. There has been a great interest in throughout Mormon history in the concept of God and salvation, because those are the two most critical concepts historically in all of Christian religion, Christian doctrine. The interest as Mormonism began in, of course, as Mormonism began, nobody knew what the beliefs were. In the very early years, most of the preaching that was done by Mormon missionaries was simply putting the Book of Mormon in people's hands, telling the people that they need to repent and accept the gospel of Jesus Christ, and that there had been a restoration of the ancient Christian religion. Well, the interest in the subject of the Mormon concept of salvation and God soon began to develop as there was more and more LDS literature published presenting ideas peculiar to Mormonism on salvation and the concept of God. One of the very earliest ideas that was presented was, and in fact we find this in this very important revelation that is section 76 of the Doctrine and Covenants entitled The Vision. This particular section was one of the most, was probably next to section 20, probably the most widely circulated section of the Doctrine and Covenants. And in the vision, there is a quotation, there a statement that those Christians who came in contact with the Doctrine and Covenants took offense at. And this is, as far as I can tell, the beginning of the concept of deification in Mormon thought. And maybe I ought to just make a comment on deification at this point. While deify is a well-known term with such synonyms as immortalize, idolize, reverence, venerate, and worship, in the context of the history of Christian doctrine, the term deification has taken on a more specific meaning. It is a term used to refer to a view shared by many early Christians that the ultimate destiny of those saved is to bear the image of God and to be God or gods themselves in some sense. Throughout this discussion, deification will be used, I will be using deification in this narrow sense of reference to the deification of man or to the belief that men may become gods. Although Mormonism has maintained almost from the beginning that men have the potential of becoming gods, I have seldom heard the term deification used in LDS discussions. Most frequently, the term used for this concept is eternal progression or simply as God is, man may become. So I make that comment on deification. This is a term that I've run onto in many non-LDS books and articles that are talking about the history of Christian doctrine. They're using this is a common term that's been used in these kinds of writings to make reference to the idea found in early Christian thought that men may become gods. Okay, back to this the development of this idea in Mormon thought. The vision was given to Joseph Smith, February 16th of 1832, to him and Sidney Rigdon. And in this vision, it says that in talking about those who attain to the highest or celestial glory are promised to receive of God's fullness and of his glory, becoming gods, even the sons of God. And that's verse 58. And then 7 months following this revelation, Jesus Christ, speaking of the elect of God, promised, "All that my Father hath shall be given." And then 3 months following that, another revelation declared that in the resurrection the saints shall be filled with his, referring to God, to God's glory, and receive their inheritance and be made equal with him. So those are the earliest statements that I have found that bring out the beginning, the kernel of this idea of men becoming gods. Lorenzo Snow told of his first encounter with this idea, which occurred June 5th of 1836, which was just a couple of weeks before he was baptized. And he was at a patriarchal blessings meeting in Kirtland. And back at that time, Joseph Smith Sr., who was a patriarch of the church, would call patriarchal blessings meetings, and people would come into these meetings. He'd lecture for a while, and then he would give patriarchal blessings. Well, Lorenzo Snow attended one of these just a couple of weeks before his baptism, and he was told by Joseph Smith Sr. something which had an impact on him, and he quotes Joseph Smith Sr. saying to him, "You will become as great as you can possibly wish, even as great as God, and you cannot wish to be greater." And Lorenzo Snow was puzzled by this. He called it a dark parable. And it was only the passing of several years, however, before Lorenzo Snow became one of the prime individuals who developed and preached this idea that men may become gods. And it is, of course, Lorenzo Snow's little couplet that Mormons have quoted forever and usually struggle with, and I will try and say it. I don't know that I've ever said it without pausing a little bit, but his couplet that as man is, God once was, and as God now is, man may become. I think I did it. that little couplet, of course, the thought of it was not original with Lorenzo Snow. It goes back to Joseph Smith Sr. and Joseph Smith, but in that particular form, he was the originator of that idea. When he first encountered it, it was a dark parable to him. Also during the same time frame, in the late 1830s, some of these ideas of the Mormon concept of salvation began to attract the attention of non-Mormons. A man by the name of Leroy Sunderland, who was the editor of a Christian periodical called Zion's Watchman, came across this idea and, in talking about Mormonism, leveled some pretty strong criticism of the Mormon views because of this idea that that men may become gods. And Parley Pratt at the time wrote a response to Sunderland, and in this response he says, "The Spirit should guide his saints into all truth. God is in possession of all truth and no more. Consequently, his saints will know what he knows. And it is an acknowledged principle that knowledge is power. Consequently, if they have the same knowledge that God has, they will have the same power. Hence the propriety of calling them gods, even the sons of God." Okay, now this idea of men becoming gods presents the ultimate potential of man in salvation. But Mormonism did not, and Joseph Smith did not stop with this idea. There are a couple of questions associated with this, and the answers to these questions have become very interesting in Mormon thought and have been the foundation for a tremendous amount of criticism of LDS belief throughout the years through those who are critics of LDS faith and doctrine. And those two questions, I guess there are quite a few that I could suggest here, but two questions that Joseph Smith proceeded to answer in regards to this idea, take the concept of deification in both directions, on into the future and back into the past. And the one question would be, how is it that God came to be God? And, of course, the other question would be, what does it involve or what does it entail to be a god throughout the eternities, those men who will become gods? What does that involve? What do they do throughout the eternities? Now, these are questions which, as I go back to some early Christian quotations that I will get to in a minute, you will see as we're going through early Christian quotations that these are questions which do not seem ever to have crossed the mind of early Christian writers in the way that we find them in LDS belief. The answers to those questions, as we find them in the teachings of Joseph Smith and, of course, since that time, is that God came to be God through the same process that we're going through, that he went through the same experience that we are experiencing, and that the destiny of those who become gods is to do in the future what God is now doing, which would involve the creation, assisting, directing the salvation of the people, creation of a world, and the assisting of the process of salvation of those who would go to that world. And so we see in Mormonism a well thought out, well-rounded out concept of what is frequently referred to as eternal progression. We know about how God came to be God from these ideas. We know what those men who become gods will be doing in the future. The something that is right at the center of this idea is something very important as we look back in early Christian thought. And that is the idea that, as Brigham Young expressed it, he was the first one that I've really found who put it in these terms. But he says that God and man are of the same species. And that, I think, really kind of sums up what we're saying. There is not, you don't have one order which is God and another order of angels and another order of men. There are intelligent beings who are all of the same species. God, in the thought of Joseph Smith and his successors, is of the same species as we. He is simply in advance of us. And so that, I think that's as much as I wanted to go into the idea of the Mormon idea, because those points then become important as we go back into early Christian thought and look at the ideas that were expressed throughout the first. I'm kind of limiting myself in the early Christian writings to about the first five centuries, but as I think Bill Kinect is going to, I don't know where he's going to go with this, but he may go way beyond that, but the idea certainly does not stop with the first five centuries. My reason for looking at the first five centuries is that the interest in this topic, as I have seen in Mormon circles and in non-Mormon Christian circles, centers around a question that is maybe this question: what is true or authentic Christianity? And that is a question that's important, obviously, to everyone who is involved in any faithful way with a Christian church. And as I have seen Mormons look at the look at early Christian thought on this subject, it has typically been for the purpose of attempting to prove or substantiate the idea that Christianity was in its pure form in ancient times, that there was an apostasy and a corruption of the ancient Christian religion, and that it was restored through Joseph Smith. Those who were non-LDS Christians who were looking at LDS doctrine on this subject are usually looking at it for the purpose of criticizing or condemning LDS faith by saying, you have departed so substantially from historic Christianity that the doctrine that you teach on these critical subjects of salvation and God are so far afield that you cannot in any way be considered part of the Christian fold. I have a little quotation here from the late Dr. Martin, Walter Martin, the Bible Answer man who has who spent the last 35 years of his life on a daily basis attacking LDS beliefs, writing and speaking and doing radio broadcasts and these sorts of things. And he makes this comment. He says in the introduction to his book, The Maze of Mormonism, which is one of the most widely circulated of critical works on the LDS faith. He says, we are asked to believe that the church fathers for the first five centuries did not proclaim the true gospel, that Origen, Justin, Irenaeus, Jerome, Eusebius, Athanasius, and a vast army of faithful servants of Jesus Christ all failed where Joseph Smith was to succeed. One of Walter Martin's most spoken on subjects, the subject he usually would like to talk about, was the LDS concept of God. And he's not alone in this. This, as I was mentioning earlier, is kind of the central focus of those who are looking to criticize the LDS faith. And the a fundamental position of Walter Martin and others of this persuasion is that current fundamentalist Christianity, which has grown quite significantly in America in the last decade, that this fundamental Christianity, what they believe today, their doctrines, their thinking about God and salvation, is in fact historic Christianity, and that this is what all true Christians have believed throughout all history. And since Mormons don't believe what all true Christians have been believing, they can't, of course, be true Christians. Well, the interesting thing from an LDS perspective, and I think something that raises a significant question for those who are of this anti-Mormon persuasion, is in going back and looking at the teachings of these very men that Walter Martin and those of that persuasion. He's very representative of people of that persuasion. He's naming such men as Origen, Justin, Irenaeus, Jerome, Eusebius, Athanasius. And we're going to be reading some quotations from, or at least I will. I'll be reading some quotations. I intended for you to be reading them too. I was going to bring a little handout with a list of quotations, but it just didn't happen. I will be reading some quotations from these individuals on in which they are advocating a doctrine which Walter Martin is very much offended by and others of the fundamentalist Christian persuasion, namely that men may become gods. Now, as I go to these quotations, I'm going to stop here and there, and there are a couple of things that I wanted to do in reading these quotations. I have many, many pages. I could not begin to read all of the quotations that there are in the time that's allotted for the whole symposium. And what I mean by that, or the reason I would say that, is to emphasize that in going back in early Christianity, you have a lot of diversity. You have all kinds of individuals in early Christianity who had ideas about one thing or another, and they were kind of on their own, and they had the ideas died out, and they didn't survive because there was not any major acceptance of those ideas. However, when we come to this doctrine of deification in early Christianity, it is so remarkably widespread that there is no way of maintaining that this was an aberrant view that was held by a few early Christians. We find it in almost every writer of the first five centuries. And let me just read to you some of these statements to give you a feel of what, and I had a very hard time picking out a few of these because there are just so many very good ones. And I have picked these out because they are from, and I have not included in these statements any from Gnostic sources, which anciently they were looked upon by the majority of Christians as being caught up in certain heresies. So I haven't included those that were viewed as being heretics. But starting with Justin, who lived from 100 to 165 A.D. So we're kind of we're about in the second generation of Christians. And Justin was martyred for his Christian belief in Rome in 165 and has always been viewed as an Orthodox Christian father, one of the church fathers. And he makes this statement. I think all of these statements I have in front of me right now come from a set published by Erdmans called the Ante-Nicene Fathers and two subsequent sets called the Nicene and Post-Nicene Fathers. So that's the source for most of these. He says, Justin says, "We have learned that those only are deified who have lived near to God in holiness and virtue, and we believe that those who live wickedly and do not repent are punished in everlasting fire." Irenaeus, from 115 to 200 A.D., who lived in Asia Minor. Now, keep in mind, Justin's in Rome. Irenaeus is was born in Asia Minor. Actually, he lived in Gaul, which is kind of France these days, I guess. He says, in writing against the heretics, he's writing against heresies. That's the name of his work. He says, "We have not been made gods from the beginning, but at first merely men, then at length gods." He declares, and he gives a quotation from Psalm 82, "I have said, ye are gods, and ye are all sons of the highest. But since we could not sustain the power of divinity," he adds, "but ye shall die like men, setting forth both truths, the kindness of his free gift and our weakness. For after his great kindness, he graciously conferred good upon us and made men like to himself." Another statement from Irenaeus, he says, "Our Lord Jesus Christ did, through his transcendent love, become what we are, that he might bring us to be even what he himself is." And this is something that kind of caught on. It's repeated over and over again, that making reference to Jesus, that he became man so that man may become God. Theophilus of Antioch, he was bishop of Antioch in 169 A.D., and he was writing against paganism. He says, "If man should incline to the things of immortality, keeping the commandment of God, he should receive as reward from him immortality and should become God. But if, on the other hand, he should turn to the things of death, disobeying God, he should himself be the cause of death to himself, for God made man free and with power over himself." Clement of Alexandria, very influential early Christian leader, writes, who wrote many works, he writes this. He says, being baptized, we are illuminated. Illuminated, we become sons. Being made sons, we are made perfect. Being made perfect, we are made immortal. I, says he, have said that ye are gods and all sons of the highest. Tertullian, who lived between 145 and 220 in North Africa. Okay, so Clement's in Alexandria, which is in Egypt. Tertullian's in North Africa. We've heard from Theophilus of Antioch in Syria and Asia Minor and Gaul. So see, the thing I'm showing here is that these ideas were not confined to a group of Christians in one small area. They're all over the place in these early centuries. Tertullian says, We shall be even gods if we shall deserve to be among those of whom he declared, I have said, ye are gods. And God standeth in the congregation of the gods. But this comes of his own grace, not from any property in us, because it is he alone who can make gods. Origen, who is frequently considered to be the first great Christian scholar, writing in Alexandria, Egypt, he lived there from 185 to 254. He says, the highest good, then, after the attainment of which the whole of rational nature is seeking, is defined by many philosophers as follows: to become as like to God as possible. But this definition I regard not so much as a discovery of theirs, as a view derived from Holy Scripture. Man received the dignity of God's image at his first creation, but that the perfection of his likeness has been reserved for the consummation, namely, that he might acquire it in the imitation of God, the possibility of attaining to perfection being granted him at the beginning through the dignity of the divine image, and the perfect realization of the divine likeness being reached in the end by the fulfillment of the necessary works. And here he's making a reference, which is frequently made in the early Christian writings, back to the creation account found in Genesis, where man is created in the image of God. And the thinking that is being presented in the extended discussions of these early Christian writers on this is that originally man was created in the image of God with the impress of God within him, and that this was lost through the fall, and that Christ came down to restore this so that man will once again be like God had created man in the first place. That idea is a very common theme. Hippolytus in Rome in 170 to 236, he says, you shall escape the boil. I wanted to read this whole quotation because he's quite colorful, but I've condensed it down quite a bit. But he says, you shall escape the boiling flood of hell's eternal lake of fire, and thou shalt receive the kingdom of heaven, and thou shalt be a companion of the deity and a co-heir with Christ, for thou hast become God. For whatever sufferings thou didst undergo while being a man, these he gave to thee, because thou wast of mortal mold. But whatever it is consistent with God to impart, these God has promised to bestow upon thee, because thou hast been deified. And provided thou obeyest his solemn injunctions and becomest a faithful follower of him who is good, thou shalt resemble him, inasmuch as thou shalt have honor conferred upon thee by him, having made thee even God unto his glory. Another important writer, Gregory of Nazianzus, who was in Greece, 325 to 390, and was in fact the Patriarch of Constantinople in 379, he says, what greater destiny can befall man's humility than that he should be intermingled with God, and by this intermingling should be deified? Christ arises to judge the earth and to separate the saved from the lost. After that, he is to stand as God in the midst of gods, that is, of the saved, distinguishing and deciding of what honor and of what mansion each is worthy. He goes on to say, those that are lofty in a godlike manner mayest become a god ascending from below for his sake who came down from on high for ours. I have a number of other quotations, but I think it will just belabor the point. I would like to make a few observations at this point. Let me just throw this point in. I have read these writings of these early Christians, obviously through Mormon eyes. I'm an active member of the LDS Church, and and not a cultural Mormon. I'm an active believing member of the church. And one of the things that I have seen Mormons do as they're looking back at, there's a lot of literature that's been done of Mormons who are looking back to early Christianity. LDS writers go back to the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi texts and back to early Christianity and sort through and find little things and bring them together. And in reading their works, it sounds like you're just reading a... it sounds like they found a community of Mormons back in the second or third century. I don't think that's the case. And that's one of the things that I wanted to bring out in this paper is that while there are some very striking and important parallels and comparisons between the Mormon concept of salvation and God, namely that men may become gods, which I think is a tremendously important concept. It's a concept that has at its foundation, I think, a very powerful incentive. There is an incentive there that I think pushes those who believe in this idea on to do a little better each day than they've done the day before. I think the ideas that many of the ideas that were so emphasized in the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation, in which man was pushed down to such a lowly position and had the capacity of doing not a single worthwhile thing and could not make a right decision, that the only thing any good that could ever be done by man can only be done if Christ comes into him and Christ works through him, and then it's not the person doing it, it's simply Christ doing it through him. I think that the idea of deification is a far, far superior idea to that idea. But anyway, as a Mormon, going back to this thought I wanted to interject here by stating my religious preference, is that my inclination as a Mormon would be to look in these statements of these early Christian fathers and to find in those the things that would have the most comparisons to my belief. In other words, I'm simply saying, as I've looked at this material, my inclination would be to bring together the things that have the most parallels and the least number of contrasts. And I think these statements are quite representative. I've been careful in trying to make these representative of views that were held very widely. And I made a little list here. Let me just read this list. These are the early Christian fathers who expressed these ideas in a significant way. Justin, Irenaeus, Theophilus, Clement of Alexandria, Hippolytus, Tertullian, Origen, Hippolytus, Gregory of Nazianzus, Gregory of Nyssa, Basil, Athanasius, Maximus, Augustine. And Augustine and Athanasius being two of the great advocates of what is considered Orthodox Christianity, and yet these two individuals, probably nobody more than Athanasius nor Augustine, advocated these ideas, this idea that men may become gods. But let me just ask you, I want to leave enough time for Bill to present some of his ideas, but let me just ask you if you have seen anything, what is missing? Anybody want to just... As I was reading those quotations from the early Christian fathers, in comparing that to the Mormon concept of deification, what is missing?
Mm-hmm. Could I propose that we answer that question after Bill presents?
Sure. I'm going to answer it right now, but you can answer it your way after Bill.
Sure.
But I just. As I was going through those, the aspects of the LDS concept that are not there are the areas where Joseph Smith has expanded, has gone back and forward. There is in these statements nothing about what it means to be a god, what they do throughout the eternities. I haven't found anything about that. In the LDS point of view, those who become gods will be creating future worlds in the future. They will be supervising those. They will be guiding people through salvation and through the same process that we're going through here. That idea, I have not found a hint of it in any of these early Christian writings. Bill will probably stand up here with a whole stack of things that I didn't see. But the other thing, too, is the idea that how did God come to be God? In early Christian thought, that just isn't there. The emphasis in these early Christian writers was that God and man are not of the same species. They are not alike. God is God by nature. Men become gods by adoption or by grace. And so this idea of man and God being the same species and that God is simply in advance of man is an idea which, in comparison at least to these early Christian writers, as far as I've been able to find, it's not there as it is in Mormonism. And so I think that that's to me, I think that's important. I don't know that should threaten any Mormons in any way. I would imagine that those who are non-LDS would probably pick up on these ideas to try and counter Mormons who would maybe be saying that Mormonism does compare favorably with early Christianity in these areas. They'd say, well, there are a lot of differences, and there are differences, and I think those need to be acknowledged. I have a lot more material, but I'm going to just cut this short right here by turning to a statement by a non-Mormon who has looked at Mormon thinking on this subject and has commented on it. He presented a paper at Brigham Young University a few years ago. This is published in the book Reflections on Mormonism. This man is Ernst Benz, and he writes an article entitled Man in the Image of God. And I like the way he said this. He says, in no other Christian doctrine is the connection between God and man so closely conceived, the idea of man as the image of God so concretely and literally interpreted, man brought into such close proximity to God, and God, on the other hand, so strongly directed to man as in Mormonism. One can think what one wants of this doctrine of progressive deification, but one thing is certain. With this anthropology, Joseph Smith is closer to the view of man held by the ancient church than the precursors of the Augustinian doctrine of original sin were, who considered the thought of such a substantial connection between God and man as the heresy par excellence. Athanasius, the great bishop of Alexandria, the head of the church in all Egypt, summarized the Christian doctrine of salvation in the words, God became man that we may become God. The goal of salvation is deification, and Athanasius invokes in this context the words of Jesus, be therefore perfect even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. So this idea of men becoming gods was a very, very common, widespread, widely taught doctrine all around the Mediterranean beginning in the second century. And for a doctrine to be that widespread, it probably has, while it can't actually, I suppose, be documented because the documents earlier than that don't exist, but it is very suggestive that it came from somewhere else and spread out. It didn't just happen here and here and here and here. These were not just simply disconnected, aberrant Christian writers who had come up with their own brand of Christianity. I do think that that as I have looked, compared, and contrasted Mormon thought on this subject with early Christian thought, that there is a lot that impresses me about the concept is so powerful in my way of thinking. It's a very positive thing, the comparisons, but I do think it's important not to try to take the comparisons too far, and we need to acknowledge that Christianity in those early centuries was not Mormonism, and those who were writing and teaching these ideas then did have a number of ideas that Mormons today would not be comfortable with.
Van has told you about some of the writings of the fathers and the doctors of the church. Let me suggest that it's possible, in my view, to learn what the earliest Christian church, the primitive Christian church, of which Pelikan and Harnock speak, to learn what they thought about deification by looking at the New Testament scriptures. Latane Colvette, who has written some anti-Mormon literature attacking the our concept of deification, called me on the phone and challenged me to show from the scriptures any suggestion that men could become gods or might be treated as gods. And I want you to do what I did with her, because we have not time to do it here. But take the revelation of St. John. Take chapters 2 and 3, where the promises are made to the seven churches. And take yourself a piece of paper and make a list. I find 19 separate promises that are made to those who prevail. Those who overcome is the phrase. Not only will they get a new name, white robes, eat, converse, walk with God, but they will be as the potter, taking the fragments and making worlds. Latane said, but nowhere is man ever worshipped in the scriptures. She's wrong. God promised those who overcome that they, sitting on a throne, would be worshipped by those who falsely call themselves Jews, but are not. And I suggest that those who falsely call themselves Christians and wrap themselves in those righteous robes will worship someday at the feet of those who overcome. We're not sure who wrote Hebrews, but that letter from the general authorities to the Hebrews quotes with approbation the psalmist who asked, what is man that thou considerest him? Thou hast made him a little lower than the angels. Look in your marginal notes. The old missionary Bible at least has the word gods. It was Elohim in the Hebrew, of course. The translators couldn't bring themselves to put gods everywhere the word angel now appears. But take your concordance and look up Elohim and go through the ancient scriptures. Look how often Elohim's translated angels. The great commentator, in writing about the Psalms, said the proper translation is, what is man? Thou hast made him a little lower than the gods. Thou hast made him lower than the gods for a little while. Thou hast made him lower than the gods for but a little while. Now, what comes of all that is, I think, best described by Harnack. Yaroslav Pelikan quotes him with approbation. The twin pillars of primitive Christianity, not the first 500 years, because we have to, I think, acknowledge that even those great fathers and doctors had already begun to suffer from the influence of the university. In the first 300 years, Harnack says, and Harnack was an agnostic, he says primitive Christianity was based on two concepts. Can't you see St. Paul sitting in the square, his Greek contacts coming to him? They engage in a dialogue. Paul, trained as a lawyer, asked them some leading questions. He says to the Greeks, is it not true you have always hoped that you would become gods? And no Greek could deny it. Their mythology was full of it. Would you not like to know how to become gods? And of course, asking leading questions like that is bound to get an affirmative answer, and it did. Harnack says the twin pillars of primitive Christianity were these: the incarnation of Jesus Christ and the potential of men and women to become gods and goddesses. That is pretty plain. That's pretty plain. Now, von Harnack, Pelikan are not the only ones. I find it interesting that Von Brody and Jan Schips both say, well, Von Brody says Joseph copied almost everything that he found for Mormonism, except this strange doctrine of deification. She could not have been more wrong, I suppose. Jan Schips says, and Jan knows better, she and I have talked about this, that one of the unique contributions of Joseph Smith, that Mormonism is to Christianity as Christianity was to Judaism, is her thesis, that Joseph Smith's original contribution was the potential of men and women to become gods and goddesses. She's wrong. Van's already illustrated that it was not new. That great Athanasius, who didn't write the creed, acceptance of which, our refusal to accept which prevents us from being Christians, did originate, so far as we can tell, I think, didn't he, Van? God became man so that men can become gods. I think if Von Brody had known that, she'd have accused Lorenzo Snow of plagiarism on that one, too. But she was comfortably ignorant. Now, it is comfortable to be ignorant of this concept. You know, Scott Peck, in his first book, talks about our potential. And he talks about one of his patients who was always being used, like a yo-yo, always used. I want to do something different. I want to be in control of my life, she said to him. And he describes the experience. They role-played. It worked. She came back and she was ecstatic. I was in control. And Peck says, you can do that all the time. How? Well, you have to do this and this and this. And she wilted and she said, I can't do that. Why not? He asked. Well, what do you want me to do? Become a god? He says, of course she didn't. We don't, because it's too much work. I wrote to Anthony Hokema, who has written almost as many anti-Mormon books as Dr. Martin. Hokema, in an article in Christianity Today, talking about the hereafter, quoted C.S. Lewis. Well, I'm one of those simple souls who's a fan of C.S. Lewis, and I had, in the course of reading, collected 6 or 7 very clear expressions, not the least of which is that great sermon, The Weight of Glory, where he talks about our neighbors and the regard we must have for them. And we must regard them well, because we may someday wake up and find they are gods and goddesses in the kingdom. I asked Hokema how he explained, how he dealt with that expression of his friend Lewis. Hokema wrote back and said, it's interesting you should mention that. He said, I preached 2 weeks ago from that very sermon, The Weight of Glory. Magnificent expression, he said. Most powerful expression. And then he added, but of course I left out those words, gods and goddesses. They're too troublesome, he says. They make us ask too many hard questions. Well, of course they do. This whole exercise is a sieve. The proper question I submit to you is not why Mormons believe that men and women can become gods, and incidentally that they have the mechanism by which this may be accomplished. Van's already destroyed any credibility, any merit to that kind of a question. But let me suggest to you, in conclusion, that the proper question is this, and if anybody ever engages you in a conversation on the subject, the proper question is this: why doesn't everybody believe it, since in the past, everybody has? Robert Browning, the Italian humanists, St. Anselm, who led the English church out of the Dark Ages, the fathers that Van's quoted, the New Testament writers, and the Old Testament writers. We don't even need to bother the heads of our evangelicals and our other Christian friends over the writings, with the writings of the intertestamental period. They are confusing. There are some magnificent things there. But I suggest again, the proper question is, why doesn't everybody? Thank you.
Thank you. We'd like to thank Van Hill for his excellent and thoughtful paper, and we appreciate the response as well. We have a few moments for questions, and we begin in the back.
Well, I'd like to ask the very question to staff.
I think Scott Peck gives us the answer. It's too hard.
But where?
Yeah. I don't know. I had an extensive correspondence with Father John Willis, the great Catholic theologian on the patristic period. Father John says that it's not been lost. The Catholics maintain that tradition. They have some different words for it. You've got to go through their indices under sanctification. John Wesley knew that word. But if you take their expressions and discussion of sanctification and go through your Bible concordance looking up sanctification, you're going to find they end up pretty much the same place that we do. The mechanisms, as Van points out, are different. Now, there are people who have different views, incomplete views. I'm not sure ours are complete. I certainly don't understand it all. It was not completely lost, is all I can say.
Can you respond to that?
Bill?
Let me just make a comment on that. I saw a little note up here that said, talk into the microphone. On the question, where was it lost, Bill is right. It isn't lost. It's around. It's just that it does not have the prominence that it had. You don't have great writers and scholars and everything presenting it who are heads of Christian churches. It is alive in the Greek church, in the Greek Orthodox church. It is alive to an extent, as Bill said, in the Catholic church. But what happened, obviously, as Christianity developed, there became this very strong emphasis on the Trinity and on there being one God. And you start talking about other people who can become God or gods, and then all of a sudden you're opening yourself up to the idea of polytheism or to the charge of polytheism. And Christianity has, a certain segment of Christianity has been so concerned about being charged with polytheism, that's of course what was behind the one of the major aspects of the Trinity, was to maintain absolutely that there is only one God, that there never has been and there never will be anything of the same nature or anything, any being or anything that will ever rival that. And as that idea just became more and more firmly planted, these expressions that men may become gods become fewer and fewer.
Yes.
I also think one of the problems about the historically obtained idea about species similarity between God and man is that a lot of these people are writing out of the Neoplatonic cosmological worldview, where there's a sort of great chain of being. It's kind of, there's a chain of links that from inanimate life all the way up to the throne of God that sort of progresses on up. And so there was an essential connection. And like almost a substantial connection between human mind, human rationality, and human will, and that of the angels. We're just a little lower than the angels. We're just a little lower, than God. And I think one of the problems is that now we have a very, very different view of the universe, modern view that's broken that chain, and that in the attempt to try to square Christian teaching with this idea about the connection or the non-connection between God and man, that people are running around on new cosmologies and physical views of the universe that breaks that chain. I think one thing that's very important you pointed out is that the idea of deification, the doctrine of deification, is still very, very prominent in the Orthodox tradition. Even though all those people really again sort of deny the species similarity between men and God.
Can I add a note on that? I went to an Orthodox wedding. Have you ever been to one? they crown the bride and groom. And in the expression of the service, it's to remind them that they are kings and queens, representative of gods and goddesses in another world, and that they are to have due regard for the responsibilities they're assuming in the union that they're forming. It is strong in the Greek tradition.
Yes, my reading isn't broad enough, but my feeling is that the trend is being set in, and maybe Van Zyl has read enough to be able to answer the question. Is there not a trend now in the writings of many people, both popular and scholarly, that this is a truth coming back to our society? Or is it not?
Well, in the writings that I've been looking at, which have been historical types of writings, the virtually every, I think every, how do I say this? I think every author writing on the history of Christian doctrine, coming from a good press, is acknowledging that this was a very important doctrine. In fact, let me just throw in one quote here that I wanted to read. This comes from a book, and it's very much along the line of a statement or a quotation that Bill made reference to, if I can just find it. This comes from a current book, which is being used widely as a textbook in theological schools. It's published by Fortress Press, and it's called The History of Christian Doctrine. And it's $50. At least it was a few years ago when I bought it. It's probably $75 now, so it's not just a cheap paperback. He says, on page 149, in our discussion of individual theologians and in our survey of the Christological controversies, we have touched on various aspects of patristic thought about man's salvation. There are two central ideas repeatedly expressed by the writers of this period. The first of these is the concept of deification or divinization. We use these terms as synonyms, as the goal of salvation. And he goes on to the other one. But he's seeing this as one of the two recurring theological themes in early Christian thought.
Yes.
I just like what this gentleman said, quoting Psalms a little lower than the angels. Actually, this takes the process back to the Septuagint translation, because the Hebrew says a little lower than the Elohim, which would be translated to gods, and or God, however you take singular or plural. And apparently the Septuagint translators, you know, some 3 centuries BC, were so troubled by that, and I think it is their Platonic monism, you know, that basic Platonic and Neoplatonic worldview, questing for a monistic God, that forced them to, you know, literally alter that to angeloi, to angels. And then, for some strange reason, I don't know why, the King James translators chose the Septuagint over the Hebrew text there. And then there was one note too about the preservation of some primitive things in Orthodox liturgy. I don't know if you've attended an Orthodox service in Greece, but there are some startling reminiscences to a few particulars about temple ceremony. For example, the men are all seated on one side of the congregation, the women are all on the other, and they go up to receive their communion. And things. There's a few interesting features.
Since we're short on time, maybe just one final question, and then if